deal. And so I, that's a, she done got that in the mail.
Yeah, that, I haven't seen them in a while, but.
They come by and seen me, let's see, about 2 years ago. Yeah. She says she's coming back to see us. And I hear from all of them.
Well, you'll have a hard time maintaining your privacy out here.
Oh, we have a good time. Yeah. Back in 1975, Miles Horton, he paid my way to go to New Mexico and visit the health clinic back in the mountains. So me and Eula Hall, went together. And Eula, I flew from Knoxville and she flew from Kentucky. So when, and Eula didn't really know me that well, but she knew all of us, you know.
Yeah.
So I was on my plane going toward Albuquerque and I seen this woman. I couldn't find her. And I seen this woman running toward the plane. And she got on there and she kept looking around and she looked and she finally looked at me and she said, "Are you Kate?" And I said, "Yeah, are you Eula?" So we had a good time. But anyway, the story was we stayed with a family of Mexicans there in Tierra Amarillo, New Mexico, back in the mountains. And they had built a health clinic there. That's what Miles wanted me to come back and write a little article for him.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, this family, we just got attached.
He's hung in.
That was in 1975. In fact, so me and that one of the girls have been in touch with each other ever since, 40 years. And she's coming to see me in June. Her and her husband's flying in to see me. After all these years.
One of the women out from out there that was involved with that health clinic?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so she's come, her, he's retiring. He worked for the border, out on the border some way. Anyway, he's retiring and he said, "Rosa," said, "where would you like to go?" I said, "I know you've not ever been anywhere much." And he, she said, "I want to go see Kate." So they're coming in June. We're going to...
Boy, I bet that's going to be some reason.
Yeah, it will. But I've kept in touch with, she had four kids. And I helped her, her husband left her. And I just kind of stayed close to her and helped her with her kids. So we just feel like she's part of our family.
Wow.
Well, what other relations did y'all have with Miles Horton?
Well, we used to go down to meetings. And in fact, Rosa Parks was there one time when we went. And I used to go and sit in the rocking chair and rock with Horton, with Miles. And John Glenn was working over there at the time.
Yeah, he was heading it up at one time.
We met a lot of folks.
Yeah. Well, did Miles and J.W. do stuff as well?
Yeah, they just sort of, well, Miles was always there when we'd go to meetings and things. They'd hang out. He was always right there.
Yeah.
In fact, Miles was involved in something around Monterey, back in there with the miners. They was on a big strike, and Miles Horton took food in there to the people.
Mm-hmm.
He done a lot of good things.
No, he was a good man. Well, I had heard, I've written out, I said I was going to let this one die. I heard Miles was not sure he wanted to hang around J.W. because J.W. was too poison. When Miles Horton says that, man, you, did you and your dad, you heard anything about that? I swear I heard.
They both were controversial men.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's always real good to me.
Oh yeah, of course he'd be good to you. I mean, he'd be good to J.W. too. He just, if somebody that's raising enough hell to for Miles Horton will be scared to be around him. That's a lot.
Well, that's what we tell him. I said, "J.W., quit. Don't tell everybody everything that went on that years ago. But he tells he gets on that roll with his that strip mine in there. Sometimes I declare that I'm not going to let him talk about it this house. But, yeah, my ass is okay.
All right.
I'll tell you something funny on Irwin. Irwin stayed with us 2 summers. And Irwin, he was, of course, he's Jewish, and he had been up, you know, he wasn't used to the greens and stuff we had. And he'd say, well, I believe that if you cook that, I'll try to eat it. Well, he said, I just can't eat turnip greens. Now he loves them. We had lots and lots of fun. But we got a lot of things done.
Oh, well, we've got your kitchen help since we've been here this summer. I'm proud of you, Pam, such a good kitchen help.
Well, you know, the Department of Labor, they're paying our daughter to help us.
That was a great thing. Yeah. Y'all deserve it.
We sure do appreciate it, too. Lord, he's cutting
onions up now. J.W., we've been sitting around here like millionaires. What can we do to help you?
You want soft drinks, water, or tea?
Where do you got tea? Oh, let me help you.
Pinto beans. The pinto beans was minor strawberries.
Minor strawberries, that's yeah.
Repeat the menu here. I was over there paying attention to something else. What we got?
That's the chicken and dumplings.
And who made those?
Faith.
Uh-huh.
And this is corn casserole.
Oh boy.
And
minor strawberries.
Minor strawberries.
Excellent.
And you want tea?
I'm gonna just have a glass of water. I can help myself.
When the folks first got here and you noticed something funny about them,
they thought they was fooling me. They was fooling everybody. So Bill Dow was the head of the students, and he told them, he said, now you got to cut your hair. Uh-huh. So Sue Colby, she put a bowl on some of their heads, and she cut a lot of their hair. Well, I caught on right quick, because her necks was white, you know what I mean? They laugh now, they say, Kate, notice, she found out right quick. And we had we lived in a big old house out there at Petros, and it had a hall. This way, this was the girl's room, and this over here is the boy's room. So they used to laugh and say that I enforced it. I watched, I put the girls on one side and the boys on the other, and then I had one boy to tell me, he said, you know, that made me a better man. But we enjoyed them. We loved them all.
Well, it's a good thing, because you'd have been miserable. You had enough of them.
Yeah. Well, I don't reckon we ever had a meal that way, wasn't 2 or 3 extra.
and from now on, when you're coming up here, don't come up here and tell not to fix something deep.
I should have known better now.
Well, as far as this, and here in Nashville, you can eat after you get here. we'd have had a little better assortment if you'd come at dinner time.
We had about as good as strawberries as I've had.
You want to get the chancellor at Vanderbilt and all the teachers gonna mention them in this story.
If you tell us about them.
Well, I don't know how to word it, but the Vanderbilt University, the most productive year was when the Student Health Coalition, for the area, there's more things happen from that group of people than ever happened to any other group of people. And it was because that the students had decided that they wanted to have a student health coalition and give free medical exams to rural areas. Mm-hmm. And Chancellor Hurd and Jean, his wife, were big supporters of it. And Dr.
Billings.
C. and
Christy.
Mm-hmm.
Christian and Billings.
Billings.
And both the Hartmans, Bob's daddy and mother. Mm-hmm. They were supportive of the students, and from that group of people, we've had several health clinics built, and one of them, I think part of it's still in operation. I believe the Mountain People's Health Council, I believe they're still in operation, and we were the ones that named it, because when we got up there and got our clinic built, we was using the doctor between Stony Fork and Petros, Norma, and they said that we didn't have enough population to get a doctor. Health Service Corps doctor. So we went together and put the clinics together and called it the Mountain People's Health Council. And so that way we got us a doctor. And then a few years later, Winfield Dunn had shut the prison down. When the prison started back up, we had enough population to get our own doctor. Mm-hmm. So we got the first Catholic out of the Holy Cross Brethren that got a doctor's degree. We got him, which wasn't a good deal. But he was a pretty good doctor, but he I think that he might have been that way.
He didn't like us.
And he resented, of course, being from that type of background. He resented the Mountain people telling him anything. Mm-hmm. And we had one woman in the community, a girl, that she come up with her pap smear was positive 4 times, I think. So she got scared and went to Oak Ridge, and they did a complete hysterectomy on her. Mm. And when she come back, she was telling the people that the clinic people wasn't any good. They was going to let her die, that she had to go to Oak Ridge to get help. Mm. So I just went over and talked to Dr. David Stanley, which was a friend of ours. And Dr. Is a woman doctor, Dr. Darling. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Stanley come over at, we had I was the president of the PTA, and we had a PTA meeting, and at this meeting, we got them to come and talk to the women. And they talked to them and told them that how many unnecessary hysterectomies were done a year. And so it kind of straightened the things out that the clinic wasn't our fault.
Right.
And he got upset. He said he didn't want us teaching him or telling him how to practice medicine. And I said, well, we're not telling you how to practice medicine, but we're telling you how to deal with people in the community.
Right.
Well, a bunch of, I'm sure, Vanderbilt kids and people got together and passed a law in Tennessee that any health provider had to give birth control devices to any one that asked for them. Mm. And I was the president of the health council, and I said, "Now we won't do that." And they said, "It's the law, you got to." I said, "It don't make any difference." I said, "I know who they'd be looking for if one of the kids gets in trouble, so I just worded a petition from the floor that we would not give any birth control devices to any minor without the president's legal consent of its legal guardian." Mm-hmm. And we got by with it. I don't know, we would never challenge it on it, but we that's what we did.
As Bill Ford says, we got by with a lot of stuff back then, we wouldn't get by with now.
And they, Chester, he decided that he'd take our clinic over, and so we just Kate contacted people in Washington over the health service corps people, and they sent a representative down here, and we explained what was going on, and so they went to Chester and told him, said, "What you need to do is get your stuff and get out of there," and said, "Don't give them people any trouble anymore." Mm. And so the strip miners down there at Coalfield that didn't like me, they built a clinic for him down there at Coalfield. Mm. And he took our nurse practitioner with him. And so that told us without any medical coverage.
Right.
And there was a man and his wife come and wanted to talk to us about them coming into the community. And we told him the story. And so he went down and talked to Chester and told him that Ben and the wife's thinking about coming into this community. He said, what do you think about it? And he advised him not to do it. So that we never did get anybody, and some of the good citizens burned the clinic after that. But they had set it on fire four times before they ever burned it down.
Well, it burned down when? What year was that?
Lord, I don't know.
Somewhere in 70.
Yeah.
No,
it wasn't that soon. I don't think, was it?
Huh.
He said sometime in the 70s, but it,
yeah,
it did.
I think it was more in the 80s. Yeah. Because
well, it may have been the 80s.
Yeah. No, back then, we had the dirtiest politics in this county there ever was. And so I was on the county health council. Mm-hmm. So they decided that they asked me about coming to Petros and having the health fair. And I said, well, yeah. So we got through our PTA, we just decided to take the superintendent of schools and you can have the building. So one night I was sitting in the health council, and these men that was, they didn't want us to have nothing out there. So he said, we're going to make a resolution tonight that this is UT territory, and said we're not going to have Vanderbilt in here. So I just got up and I said, I'll have you to know that this is America. And they're already been invited and they are coming in. Mm-hmm. So they did.
Was this the very first health fair?
Yeah, one we had. Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's how we got. And the superintendent of school, he just turned the school over to us. And both years, we had that 2 year different years. And But I had to stand up and show out and do everything.
Before he got to be superintendent of schools, when he was running, why, Sockham had some success at Nashville, was getting laws passed and stuff. So he come in, he said, J.W., he said, if you help me get elected superintendent, we was trying to get a school built. He said, I'll see about helping you get a school building. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. So I don't know what I had to do with it, if anything, but he got elected. So I waited about a little while, and I told him, I said, I want you to come up to the school. I was president of the PTA, and so we, him and the school board, come up there to a meeting. And when we got through our PTA business, and it wasn't PTA, it was PTO. So we changed it from PTA to PTO, Petros Action Club, so that any money that we raised or anything would stay in the community. We wouldn't have to be involved with the Parent Teachers Association.
Ooh.
And I turned the floor over to him, and he got up and he said, well, he said, really, I don't think it's time to go before the county court and ask for a bond issue to build a building. And I said, Mr. Galloway, I said, we didn't invite you up here to ask you what your opinion was. I said, you told us if you got elected, you would see about working with us. So I just ordered a petition from the floor. All the people signed it. And so they had to go before the county court on Monday, and that was Thursday. So the JPs didn't have time to get together and decide how they was going to vote. And it passed. And some of them cussed and said, hell, if I know it's going to pass, I wouldn't voted for it. And so they decided that they would sue school board and the superintendent and prevent them from using that money to build Petros school. So I just called a lawyer at Knoxville and asked him if he'd take the case, and he said, yeah. So me and Kate went out that evening, got enough people to sign a petition that would pay for the lawsuit in case we lost. So they presented it to the county executives out there, and they said, you'll have to use that money for what it was appropriated, what it was voted out for, school. And they asked, my lawyer said, what do you want to do with this lawsuit now that y'all got your way? And I said, we'll put that lawsuit in the foundation when you pour it.
You remember Dana Ford Thomas?
Yeah.
Well, he called me one day and he wanted me to, he asked me if I would come and make a talk before all the superintendents in the state about my education in the rural areas. So, of course, you know, I'd done everything. I said, yeah. So I got down there and the office crowd ever was. And so I got up and told them about how that my life had been and about the difference in just across the mountain was Oak Ridge. And I said, I'd gone to both schools. And so I said, the difference in what we had been given. So, but he got me to get up and talk. So the commissioner of the school system in the state, he got up and he said, I want you to sit with me through dinner. So I sat with him, and he got up that night, and he said, I just wished everybody here could have heard Kate Bradley this morning. And so when we had our school built, well, he come. And when they broke ground, he wanted me to be there. And I've still got the dirt where they took the...
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my two granddaughters go today.
Now, that school is it on 62?
Uh-huh. Petros Joiner.
So if you go to 62, you turn left, and it's not far down the road.
Yeah, yeah. It's right down the road a little piece.
Well, we might just have to have a look, see it there on the way back.
Yeah, okay.
Well, y'all were involved in so much stuff over the years. What percentage of time or your energies went into Sockham, and how much, you know, into PTA or whatever else you were involved with?
We just kept both of them going the best we could. She'd be in Nashville testifying, and I'd be in Washington. Senator Fred Harris was our best contact in Washington. And Senator Fred He is from Oklahoma, and he was trying to get all these big corporations busted up where they wouldn't have so much political power, and so he is holding land reform conferences across the country. And the first one he helped was in Kentucky. And we went up there, me and Billy Christopher and Kate and Connie, and we testified at that meeting about how that the area was being stripped by and tore up. And there's a girl come up to me and she said, we need you in Washington. I said, when? She said, now. So they chartered a bus and took a bunch of us to Washington. And she was from our environmental
policy center.
She was a lawyer for Friends of the Earth, again, the supersonic transit plane that they was trying to build back that time. Mm-hmm. And after they won their lawsuit, Arthur Godfrey said, we need an environmental group, said, I'll give you all $10,000 if you'll start an environmental group. So he gave them $10,000, they started Environmental Policy Center.
Arthur Godfrey.
And so that they took us up there to Washington, and they was people from Montana and different places. It was at this conference. Mm-hmm. We was going up there on this Greyhound bus. We didn't have, we didn't have any idea we were going to Washington. When we left, we didn't have no change of clothes or nothing. No. So we got up there, and when we was going up there, of course, we was sitting on the bus talking, and there was a girl, she was a granddaddy was the head of Nabisco Baking Company out there in Montana, and she had been to school at these girl colleges, and all you men are all alike. Said, any part of the country you go, said, men are all alike. Said, they think that women ought to just stay at home and have kids and look at four walls. And I said, no, lady. I said, you got me all right. Well, I said, I'm not like that. I said, I think a good-looking woman like you ought to just have life squeezed out of her, laid on the couch and looked at. She turned around in her seat, and she wouldn't speak for a long time. But the funny part of it was the next day when they was assigning us to go lobby, well, she said, Mr. Bradley, said, can you and I lobby together? And I said, well, I am. I said, you and I can't even get along. She said, we can on strip mining. And we lobbied together and got to be good friends, and her and Ann Charter from Montana got money together to send me out Montana to Helena, Montana before the legislation and talk about strip mining, and the people of the Fish and Game Department out there after I testified before the legislation, they asked me to go to Great Falls, Montana with them and testify for them on some hearings, and I did, and they gave me a book yearbook from Montana for 3 or 4 years. But Ann Charter's husband, he was rode with a bunch of outlaws mm-hmm. out there during the outlaw days, and they had some way or other they had purchased a big part of Bull Mountain out there. And I was at the airport there one day, and he asked me if I'd seen that mountain, and I said, yeah, and he said, we own a big part of that. And come to find out, Bill Greenberg had been out there years before and wrote a story about Charter. And they had tried to buy his land, and he wouldn't sell it. And they said, well, we're going to make you an offer for it. And he said, it don't make any difference what kind of offer you make. He said, you'll always be as much as $1.50 short of what I'll take for it. And so him and his wife was holding off strip miners out there. They were good friends. I was good friends of them. And when Carolyn Alderson was the woman that I had words with.
Yeah.
And Carolyn and I wound up as lobbying partners any time we was in Washington together. We'd lobby together.
Jim, go get the yum-yum.
Huh?
Go get the yum-yum.
Well, look, maybe they want a second.
Y'all want another dumpling?
No, I would like it, but I there ain't room there.
Well, all right, he's got a good dessert, that girl.
Why don't we help take plates and stuff like that?
Here you go, Biff. Oh, why don't you?
Right, there's plenty of paper plates you want for
you. So, Kate, how before the Health Coalition came, y'all were already community leaders, but on different issues. Was education what you really kind of...
You know, really, we were really deep in our church
uh-huh.
back then. And we helped build churches and raise money. And I always raise money mm-hmm. and delivered word, you know. But we were involved in our church really deep until... We got involved, we met John
Devina. That was he the kind of the first person yeah. of everybody
yeah.
from Vanderbilt?
He come to our house one day.
Get up, big boy.
He come to our house one day, and him and another boy and a girl. And they sat on the porch, and I had them a lemon pie. I had a lemon pie made. They just come by. That's how we met John.
So John, I'm sorry, I was out. John Gavino was the first person who got in touch with y'all?
Yeah, that I knew of. And anyway, John always then come back. He'd laugh. He'd say, I come back for some more lemon pie. but he couldn't understand why that there's so much minerals in our country, the coal and different stuff, and lumber and timber. And he said, then we didn't have nothing coming back. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't understand it. So that's what drew him there.
Hmm. But Tom, I was asking Kate about, you know, kind of how they got in, you know, involved in, you know, civic yeah. things and whatever. And they started out in their church becoming leaders first, before uh-huh. any of either schools or uh-huh. in strip mining or whatever. That's where you
yeah.
kind of cut your teeth on. Being a community yeah. leader
building churches. We built two churches, or helped build two churches.
Biff, you want to help serve there?
Yeah. Can I help you?
It's Cherry Yum Yum.
One of them's blueberry, one of them's cherry.
Take it and get some of each at the same time, or
Biff will serve us, JW.
Yeah.
Biff, I'll have just a small amount of each, I do mean a small amount.
All right. What can I get for you, JW?
Hi.
Would you like some?
No.
And mostly,
no.
Now, J.W. worked more with soccer, and I pretty well worked with health programs.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But it was your church where you really got your start.
I was a young people's leader in church for years. And we did all kinds of programs, and I had a half of our little church was full of young people.
What was the name of the that
Church of God?
Uh-huh. In Petros.
Where in that church? Where was that church? Is that?
It's there on this road. Before you get into Petros.
Okay. Yeah.
And do you have any idea, since John Gavena was the very first person from the Vanderbilt crowd that contacted you? Do you have any idea who told him go see the Bradleys?
No, I don't know. They just was traveling through the mountain there, I think, and they come by and I give them dice.
John Gavena and Bill Greenberg was the first two contacts we had with.
I don't know. I
don't know how we done that.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
And then when we had the health fair, Helene said, would you all like a health fair? And I said, yeah. She said, okay, we'll see about it. So then she went back to Vanderbilt, got in touch with Bill Dow, and then they set up the health fair at the school.
Helen? Good grief. Was she there the first year?
No.
I don't think she was in the coalition, but she was,
yeah.
You know, she was coming around a little bit, but. She was. She said that to me, and I said, "Yeah, we'd love to have one." So we had the first health fair we had that week. We had 1,200 people that come through.
We had a area of about 1,500 people was our count area, and we had
Tom, you ain't got no spoon, have you?
Well, one of the great things that Biff has done is collected all the reports from the Student Health Coalition days, and so soon we'll have a list of, you know, since it's so hard for all of us to remember the exact dates of anything,
yeah.
What was the date of the first Petros Health Fair, what year, and what was the year of the second one, and then we can kind of... Biff is really helping us piece together the story since some of us have gotten a little cloudy on the details. And so that's one reason why coming back and having multiple interviews, he was kind of explaining how archivists work.
Yeah.
And you were talking about follow-up interviews. You can't get everything the first time around, and once we have some of these timelines and maybe a list of some of the people's names that we can't all remember and whatever, then that helps anybody who's being interviewed, you know, tell a more accurate story. So that's one reason he's trying to collect as many papers and documents as he can so that he can kind of work out the history.
Yeah.
You could say it better, but...
No, that's exactly right. Well, it seemed to me that because... a lot of the funding was coming from foundations, that each year the coalition needed to write up a report so that they could give it to the foundations. So for a librarian or archivist that wants to see the record, there it is. Every year you have a full report of the clinics, all the participants, the communities that they worked with, you know, statistics about how many people attended. So it's an impressive... artifact that still exists for every year.
All of Pete's life, she's been a reader, and she always wanted a library. So there was some land up there at Petros, and she got a chance to buy it, so she bought it. And we later on got a library built on it. And at the post office, and John and Bill Greenberg come to the house and talk to me, they was talking about us getting money into the area, etc. said that we believe that some of your land is not taxed properly.
Right.
And so we got together and decided that that's what we wanted to work on. And so we got 13 people out of 5 counties to go before the State Board of Equalization and ask for them to tax the land according to law. Mm-hmm. And they did. And the Vanderbilt kid said, well, said, we come back and made a report to the community. And they said, well, said, you all got other issues that you need to work on. Said, you need to form an organization. And I said, okay. I was the one giving the report on the tax return. And I said, next week we'll have another meeting. And I said, the person that names the company that we give, or the organization that we form, I said, we'll give them $5. And so Helen E. Cook and
Donald Todd
got together and got to mess with words, and they come up with Saucon.
So was Helen, okay. Well, that was a question we wanted to ask, and there the answer. Uh-huh. Okay. That was a question we wanted to ask us. Who was it that came up with the name?
It was just about 10 or 15 Ellie, there that
Ellie
night.
Cook and Don Todd was one
yeah,
that
they're the ones that named was a,
and something I didn't understand until we were talking to Boomer and Maureen this morning, the fight before the Equalization Board preceded Saucon, just like you were just saying. Then you formed the Saucon, was yeah. founded in the wake of the success of that first appeal by the 13 individuals.
Yeah.
And that's clarifying for me. I had it switched around in my mind.
Well, what was Irwin's interest when he was up there? I should know that.
Well, Irwin helped organize him and John Kennedy,
you know. Yeah, yeah.
Well, now they worked with the miners.
Okay.
To get black lung.
Black lung, yeah. Okay.
And they got for lots and lots of people got their money started. So they didn't even know this at that time. But now they helped a lot of people.
Irwin doing black, okay.
Irwin stayed with us in our house two summers. But back then, the foundations was giving donations for things, you know, a lot more than
somebody wrote a letter to the Ford Foundation for us, for Saucon, some money, and they'd give us some money before. And they sent a representative down here to find out what kind of people we was. And they sent a girl down here, and she said, what do you all do with the money if you get it? And I said, we'll use it for whatever we can to cover the most number of people that we can cover. And some of them was wanting to get a law firm for women's rights. And I said, we'll do whatever can get the most coverage for the most people. And she went back and they sent us, I forget how much he sent, but they doubled the amount of money.
Well, I'll tell you what it was. Mr. Henry was the head of that foundation. And he come down here and I cooked dinner for him. And he was real impressed because I'd cooked everything out of my garden. And he said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm going to build a health clinic. And he said, okay. So he said, where are you going to build it? And we walked over to the railroad track and I showed him. I said, right down there. And he come back to see Saucon. They were asking him for money for them. So he come to our house and eat dinner again. And he said, I'm going to give you $10,000 to start that clinic. And he did.
And he was with the Ford Foundation or another foundation?
He was with the
Avon people.
Avon. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Avon.
I forgot that it had a name, but foundation, but it was with Avon.
Well, let me. Also, you talked about, you know, maybe having a law firm that would help out. And day before yesterday, we visited with Neil McBride down in Knoxville.
Yeah.
With East Tennessee Research Corporation.
What's happened to Neil?
He's doing well.
He's officially retired, but he's still working on all sorts of projects. And
well, he was a board member for TVA.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I could never figure out. One of the senators told him when he went up for our interview, he said, son, he said, you know, I got chances of hell in snowball in hell getting this job. And then he come back to him, talked to him, and he said, well, looks like you got a pretty good job, chance of getting it. And he got it.
That's remarkable, wasn't it? He went from the one throwing rocks at TVA as a young man to being on the governing board. I find that remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah, he him and his wife worked for TVA when she was alive. But he wrote a testimony for me that I gave before the Senate Public Works Committee. They was holding oversight hearings on TVA, and I found out about it in Washington, and so I said, we need to be here, because I said, we've got some information on TVA, and Baker, Howard Baker, was the co-chairman, but Senator Randolph was the chairman, and I knowed I didn't have a chance with Baker, so I went to Randolph's people and told them what we had. And they said, well, that's the kind of information we want at this hearing. And Neil helped write me a testimony. And when we got up there, well, they said, you can't testify. Mm-hmm. Said, we've got a full group, and said, there's not room for you. And I said, well, could I leave my testimony and have it entered into the books? And they said, yeah. And so I give my testimony. And they put it in the record. And I've got a copy of it. It tells about what TVA is doing.
Well, J.W., can you say a little, what else did East Tennessee Research Corporation, either Neil or John or Williams or any of them, what was their relationship with Sockham? And
anytime we wanted anything done, we went to them.
Really?
And they've always been helpful. And
Pat Kelman's done a lot of fundraising to help us. She contacted a lot of foundations and she done a lot of good.
He's on telling how many thousand dollars of grants that Pat Kalman's got brought in this area.
Mm. And we used to go down to Vanderbilt to, the kids would have bean dinners, bean cornbread dinners, and have parties and raise money for us. Mm. And one time we had a cake walk. Mm-hmm. Two kids walked in, one of them said, what in the world is this? He said, I don't know, but they want a quarter. So they got in the line, give their quarter. But they didn't know what was going on, but they got in there anyway.
This was down at Vanderbilt, or in Petra? Had never been to a cakewalk, huh? Yeah, okay.
Well, Lord, we had all kinds of things. We had puppet shows, and we sold dinners, and I went to California and visited my son. He's in the Navy. And run into a boy, a man out there that had a Vanderbilt sign on it. We stopped and talked to him. He said, well, he was a doctor with the Navy. And he was, he said, I bought green beans and jelly and everything from you folks. Lord, we done a little bit of everything, and we had quilts and cooked dinners. And
one thing that they did for us, we tried every way that we could to get TVA not to accept trucks that were overweight. They was accepting trucks that weighed over 100,000. They couldn't even weigh them at their scales. And they had split weigh them. And so we entered two or three lawsuits against them. And the last lawsuit we got, we went to Kingston and got the weight records for the companies. And we picked out the biggest violators of the law so that we could have something to shoot for. And it turned out that they all four belonged to the same guy.
That was the Wall?
Walls. Mm-hmm. And we took this case to court, or they took it to court, and their lawyers got together, the strip binder trucker lawyers got together, and turned around and sued us for $100,000 for barratry, for stirring up litigation without cause. And there was a barratry statute passed in a lot of the southern states during the civil rights movements. Mm-hmm. And me and Bill Down, some of us tried to get the lawyers not to compromise the cases, but they went ahead and compromised the case because they were scared that we was going to get sued. And they said, what do you do if they sue you for $100,000? I said, well, we'll pay them off in Sock'em t-shirts. I said, that way we'll get advertisement. So after they settled the case, I got with John Gavin and some people and with the ACLU people, and we went to Nashville, and we went before a judge down there, a federal judge. You know him. He's a good guy.
Merritt? Judge Merritt? Gilbert Merritt?
Yeah, oh yeah. And did he run for governor one time, didn't he?
He might have. I wish he'd won.
He used to be the treasurer for the state, and then he tried to run for governor. He come up, and I took him on a strip buying tour, and he eat cakes, dinner, and changed clothes at our house and went for a rally.
Ooh.
And he told them at this rally, he said, if I get elected governor, he said, the people like Sock'em will be the people that I put on my environmental committee. So well, then the strip miners, all of them got together and give him a federal judgeship to get him out of the race.
Uh-huh.
And so then when I went before him, he said, Mr. Bradley, he said, what's your objection to the barratry statute? And I said, sir, I said, if it's allowed to stand, I said, organizations like us won't have a chance. And so I sat down, and the guy that was for the state going to defend it, he asked him, he said, Governor, said, what makes you think the barratry statute is constitutional? And he went on to explain to what it was. And we won the case. They declared the barratry statute in the state of Tennessee as illegal.
And y'all get you some more yum yum.
Well, okay. a little bit. Not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot. All right.
Now, we coming up here, we went through Oliver Springs, and was it all that fancy housing up there? Is that Jack Walls doing? Is that fancy houses up there?
Yeah, of course, Jack's gone now, but
yeah.
I showed you the picture of all the coal company Jack was associated with. Me, go get that and show these two people. See, we had to fight the state, the county, individuals, and everybody. The Department of Revenue had passed a law allowing trucks to run in excess of the state law. And Jean Ann Woods was the head of the Department of Revenue at that time. And Jean Ann, she had won several beauty contests before she got the appointment. And so when I went to Washington to testify about the overloaded trucks, I found out that the state had a illegal weight limit. And so Neil, I guess, wrote a letter to her telling her that if she didn't publicly admit that they were violating the law and abandon it, we was going to sue them. And she wrote me a letter and asked me, said, Mr. Bradley, said, can't we let that go for a period of time until the license come due again? And I said, lady, I said, there's no way that we can give you permission to continue to violate the law that we're going to sue you for using. And so then they publicly admitted that they were using an illegal law. And they did away with it. But some of the state officials had trucking companies, and they was the one that got this put in the law. And it was allowed the truck that was hauling sand, gravel, and asphalt, and things of that nature to exceed the weight limit. But the people with farm produce and timber, natural resources, they couldn't use it. And so,
well, they were about right, because sand and gravel were about what half of what that coal load was, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. He fell outside yesterday morning, broke his clavicle and back his eye. Mm-hmm. And bloated his nose. I happened to look out and I couldn't find him. I went out there and he was looking right at me. So I come back and got my walker and I said, I'll take this out here and y'all can get up. He got up, come in.
Can you
hear
some kind of good?
Now, I'm not good with the English.
Oh, you're going to make Biff happy. You're getting papers out.
Okay.
Biff, if we're done with the yum-yum, you want to put that in the kitchen and then...
I'll get it.
Okay.
Go ahead. This is one of the areas...
Oh, well.
You can just stick that back in the refrigerator if you want to.
I'd tell people about some of her problems, and then they'd make me a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of us. There's Bill Greenberg and me.
Who is it?
It says left bottom. Bob Peel, Don
Bob Steele,
Bob Peel, and Don Todd.
Mm-hmm.
J.W. Donnie Todd, Bill Greenberg, Jim Bryan, and Leanne Russell.
Leanne Russell.
Russell.
Leon Russell is one of the most knowledgeable people on radiation effects on mice in the United States or in the world, I guess. She's won all kinds of awards. Heard a testimony that I give the Senate Public Works Committee. Now back to our, I'll give you this picture here. There's Bill Greenberg.
Good grief. Hmm.
From his service, his funeral service.
Well, Bill Greenberg's buried in our family plot.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a classic.
That woman, I'd tell her what her problem was, and she'd do us a...
Let's see.
Did Jack Wallace ever sick his thugs on you and beat you up or anything?
Uh-uh.
He threatened, I'm sure.
He threatened me. Told me that some of his people told me that... I was in danger up there in them strip pits that I could get blowed up. And I said, if I get blowed up of my own accord, I said, that's my fault. I said, if you all ever hurt me and don't kill me, I said, I'll hunt you like hunting squirrels. Mm-hmm. And so one day we had the state conservation committee up on a strip mine tour up there. And one of the strip miners pointed me out and said, that guy right there is dangerous. Said, he threatened to hunt us like hunting squirrels. Mm-hmm. And I heard him and I said, no, buddy, I said, you're wrong there. I didn't threaten you. I said, I promised you. And I said, it's just true today as it was the day I told you. And I was lucky. My daddy was a good shot, good marksman. And I reckon that helped protect me. They know that they couldn't get by with meth and me.
Okay. Well, something had to protect you.
Back to the church part of it. We belonged to this church in 1980, I guess. Somewhere around there, the church had the world's largest non-commercial, non-government air fleet in the world. And all the churches on an airplane, their pastor would fly it. And they'd go on missionary trips and things all over the country to the islands and everything. But... that guy that was the head of the church, he preached at Ezekiel's cherubim, was the airplane. And he bought an airplane, and he'd go to airfields and put on a show and say, now this is what the Bible was talking about. So they wound up with that size airfield. And... then he decided that the motorcycles was what Joel had seen. Joel was talking about in the last days there'd be an army of people dressed in battle array. And the thing that they rode would pop and crack like fire of iron stubble. And so we bought motorcycles and painted them white. Put scripture on them. And in 1969, I guess, we had the first motorcycle ride that I ever know of. It was sponsored by church ministers riding across the country. We'd go to Florida and Pennsylvania where we had churches and do it on the week of the 4th of July, and then the women that went with us, they'd roll up a church literature in cellophane, colored cellophane paper, and we'd give it out as firecrackers. We got in the Bible Belt to North Carolina, and they said, if you all put any of these, this literature out on the ground, then we'll arrest you for littering.
So you stayed active in your church throughout, and while you were also working on Sockham and education and all sorts of things?
We built this first church, and then the church had a split in it. This guy that was over the Marketing Association, he was preaching some stuff that some of the other church didn't go along with, and so they split. And so we built another church. We bought the land to build a clinic on, and it had a depot on it. And we took that lumber and built another church. Same people that had helped build that other church. Now these, I've lost some of that testimony, but in the last of it, who was the chairman on the...
It was Mr. Gibbons.
Gibbons. He told me, he said, I told him about how that they was doing the overloaded trucks, and he said, why is TVA doing that? I said, all the thing I can do is tell you what they're doing. I can't tell you why. And he said, well, why is the state allowing what they're allowing? I said, I'll tell you the same thing. He said, well, I think it would be good to get TVA and Gene Ad Woods up here and hear from them. And I said, I sure would like to be here when it happened. And they did. They summoned TVA and her up there, and she got up there, and of course, them old senators, they just melted, and she got up and started talking, and they said that they was going to do something. They was going to correct the problem. And so instead of putting a limit on the gross weight, they told the corporate truckers that they could continue to haul like they had been hauling. But the independent truckers, if they come in over the truck, the weight limit, they was going to penalize them. They could either pay them for the total log, or they could dump part of their load. And so then when they got ready to enforce that, why, the truckers met, and Jack Walls, he told them, he said, now, make sure that non-Sockham people get in here. And they had their meeting, and his one of the truckers called me and said, J.W., said, we need some help. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, I said, TVA is going to start penalizing the independent truckers, and the corporate truckers are going to continue the way they're doing. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, if you'll guarantee me that you'll give protection, I said, I'll see if I can get you some up here to help you. And back then, I could call a Tennessean and tell them that I needed somebody, I had a problem. And they'd send Bill Greenberg and Jack Corner. And they sent them up here, and the second day, while TVA throwed in the towel, they said, you all just haul the way you want to. Said we ain't going to try to enforce the law anymore.
And did they? I mean, the law was enforced. I don't.
Huh?
And the law was enforced after that? I mean, they.
It was never enforced.
Yeah. Did y'all ever go after them for taking half coal and half dirt and rock and stuff like that?
We tried to. We took it to federal court. And me and Maureen went out and filmed layer loading. And we went to. I say a lot to me, but now all this stuff, it was all of us worked together.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that I did any of this all by myself, but a girl, the name of Karen Kosmowski, she went to work for us. She took photography down there at Nashville, and she worked for us, and me and her would go out, was trying to figure out how that the trucker or the strip miners was making so much money. And with the quality coal that he was selling. So we went out and she couldn't climb good, and I'd climb the tree and pull her up in the tree, and I'd hold a limb on her back, and she'd shoot the coal yards, and we'd take it back and look at it, and we seen there was two separate piles of coal. And you could tell by looking at them, they were distinctly different. And so I went in and got some coal out of one of them and got it analyzed at TVA and found out it was practically dirt. And so Maureen and I went in, and Boomer, and watched them load the trucks, and they loaded two-thirds of the truck out of this dirty stuff, and then they covered it up with about a third of the truck load of that other.
Now, where did you watch that from?
Huh?
Were you all climbing the trees again? Where did you?
I was in the trees sometimes. Sometimes we was on the ground. But this time we was on the ground, and we was filming it. And so then after we filmed that, we took it and showed it to this TV girl. And she went with us, and we filmed it, and she did a story on layer loading. And I'm trying to get people, somebody that knows how to get into the archives of the Channel 10 to get a copy of that. We had a copy at one time of the layer loading, and we took it around the country and showed it to people. And after Ann filmed the layer loading of coal, we followed the trucks, Kingston Steam Plant, and watched them sample it down there. And then she come back up there and she said, "I'm going up there and ask them why they're loading like that." And I said, "Well, you don't need me." And she went up there and she said, "I'd like to know just why you all are moving around the way that you are to load these trucks." And one of the strip miners got her microphone and started reeling the cameraman in. You could see the camera giving it that. And he said, "I don't know what you're up to," but said, "You're in a heap of trouble." And they run her off. I don't tell this. I ain't told it to nobody, hardly. But 2020, out of D.C., come down here to do a story on layer loading. And they come into Knoxville, and they registered it High Regency, which was built with coal money, a lot of it was. And they had just done a story in Kentucky about the number of millionaires that had been made in the strip mine industry. And they registered is 2020 at this coal motel, and I told them, I said, you all made a mistake. I said, they know that you're here now. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we want to see what we can find out. And I said, all right, you meet me in the morning at 4 o'clock. And I said, I'll take you where we're going. And I took them to a site that we could walk to right easy. And we kept waiting there, and they never, no loading going on. And I told them, I said, well, I said, we ain't going to get nothing here. And I drove them that day about a 50-mile radius of Oak Ridge, and there wasn't any trucking going on. And I said, I called the TVA lawyers that we had worked with and told them, I said, what's going on? And the way I understood this guy, he told me, he said, nothing that I can talk about now. Mm-hmm. So I told the 2020 people, I said, you all might as well go back to Washington. I said, they know you're in this area, and they're not going to do any loading of you all here. And they went on. We never got nothing out of that except experience.
Well, did you haul them around the Green Bronco?
Huh? No, they had their vehicle.
Okay.
They just come in the wrong way.
Yeah.
The thing about it was, we went to, when we first found out about layer loading, me and Maureen and probably Boomer went to the U.S. Attorney in Knoxville and showed him the video that Maureen had done of layer loading. And I said, this is going on now. We want to know what can be done about it. And he said, well, he said, what are y'all going to do? And I said, Lord, I don't know. I said, we just want people to know what's going on. We want to know what can be done. And he said another word or two to me, and I said, I'll tell you what. I said, if you want to go and see this, I said, or send somebody, I said, you tell me when, I'll tell you where to meet me, and when we get there, I'll tell you where you're at. And he got his feelings hurt because I didn't trust him. And they never did do anything, but they, after we showed this layer loading film on television, well, the FBI had to do something. And I was told by reliable sources that they did 1,800 feet of videotape, part of it from a helicopter, part of it from hiding like we were. But the thing that's doing, we'd go into an area and we'd try not to disturb anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to seeing people cutting the bushes and stuff to make little duck blinds. Mm-hmm. And I figured that was the FBI. You know, we never did run into them. But we tried to hide what we were doing. And after Ann filmed this layer loading, the manager, I guess, of Channel 10 called me and asked me, said, was you all trespassing? And I said, no, sir. I said, in fact, we was on UT property. And so then they went ahead and showed the thing because they threatened Ann that if they showed anything on television, they'd sue them for trespassing. So when he found out that they was legal, I went ahead and showed him. And the TVA lawyers contacted Ann after she had done this and asked her if Reckon Sopham would work with them and help them get this information. And she said, well, I don't see why they wouldn't. But when I asked the Sauckham people if they would work with the TVA lawyers, they said no. Said, we don't trust them, we won't work with them. But I said, if we work with them, I said, we can get them to hold the samples. And I said, then when we take it to court, well, we'll have a proof that what we were claiming was true. And so I began to work with two or three of their lawyers, and I took them to different places. And I took them to several different places. And every place we filmed, they were layer loading. And then a friend of mine with the FBI, I told him all about it. And they told him, they said, we're going to have to do something. And he knows where to go. And he went and got the film of actual layer loading. He was hid in bushes. And when he come out of the bushes, he got up on the loader and told the operator, he said, now load this next truck just exactly like he loaded that. And he said it scared that loader operator to death. That we took that information and got to go before a federal grand jury in Knoxville. Taylor was the judge. And we had TVA's records of what was going on, where we had worked with them, and we had information that the FBI had 1,800 feet of videotape that they had taken of layer loading. And so I was first to testify, and I got up and testified, and I know that what I had to say was what I thought. And I know that if they got up and showed them this positive proof, well, that was what we needed to do. So I just told them what was going on a little bit and sat down. And I found out that they wasn't asking any questions at all. This was a federal grand jury that was put together to study the layer loading, so I told Neil after the day there at court, I said, I'd like permission to go before the grand jury, back before the grand jury. He said, well, you can't, said, if you ain't got new information. I said, I don't have any new information, but I said, I've got the information that they're not using. And, of course, he never got me permission to go back before him. So then they put this grand jury under an investigating period of time and didn't do anything about it. And there was never anything done. And I called a Washington hotline, FBI, and reported. Mm-hmm. And they sent two FBI men down here, and they called me and asked me where they could meet me. And I told them, it's a library there in Oak Ridge. And I met with them and told them about what was going on. And they said, what's your opinion about why you didn't get anything done? I said, we were sold out. And buddy, I mean, that ruffled their feathers. They didn't like me no more. And they never did do anything about it. It was never any follow-up of anything of it.
It certainly wasn't easy living through all this. It wasn't easy for our family living through all this.
And then the TVA basically shut down the deep mine industry in this area. And they made millionaires out of these strip miners. And they was this company, one of Jack Walter's company was that is all, was stripping them on land that I own. They made their brag that they made each of the board members had made over $100,000 the previous year, and there was no way to tell how much they was going to make in the future. And that's when we got to trying to get something done about it. And
I remember that grand jury experience, and everybody was so hopeful that that was going to be the big breakthrough, and it was kind of a devastating disappointment, one is the way I remember it.
It was. Me and Doreen went, when we first found out about this, we went to the U.S. attorney, and I think his name was Matthews in Knoxville, and showed him, and then we went to television, radio, Senate, both state and federal, and testified about all this, and tried to get something done, and never got nothing done. And TVA, in the later years, they made a contract with the strip mine loaders, the ones that load the coal, and they made a contract with them to pay them so much money for each ton that they loaded over the company's agreement with the TVA. So, of course, they just, anything they could get in the bucket, they put in the truck. And from that, then, it was nobody never being prosecuted every time that we tried to get them prosecuted, but they'd turn them loose and say that they wasn't nothing they could do about it. And so the rest to the strip miners that wasn't layer loading began to layer load because it was such a lucrative business.
Why? I know you said you don't know the reason why, but I never have understood why TVA would allow that to happen. I mean,
well, let me tell you something else. Some of TVA's officials became silent partners to these strip mining companies. And they would tell them if they'd give them a partnership that they'd guarantee them contracts. And so after nobody could be prosecuted, all of them began to layer load. And then this paying this bonus to these loaders that was loading extra tonnage is what made the overloaded the silt basin down there at Kingston. And they was people that figured out a way, and I'm not sure that I've got it figured out yet. I think I have. They was taking coal samples and they was burning it and giving TVA results out of these coal samples that was fraudulent. And the only thing I could figure they was doing, they was taking these coal samples and adding gas to it and was getting a better reading for their sample. And if that was what they did, I don't know what it was, but if anybody was interested, I think I could find out, because I know some people that did that they was taking the coal samples and doctoring them up, and TVA was buying them doctored up samples that TVA was supposed to be was a bunch of smart people, but they were being hoodwinked by a bunch of hillbillies.
J.W., you know, in recent years, there's been all this, you know, with the issues with the coal dust and the coal slurries failing there, you know, at the TVA plant. I mean, what was your reaction when you heard all that? You were, you know, not active in Sauk'em at that time, but, you know, the coal dust and the coal slurry storage is now the as much of an issue in the newspapers and that sort of thing.
It should be more than it is. But when I was testifying before that Senate subcommittee there in Washington, and they wouldn't let me testify, they only allowed me to leave a copy of Senator Harris's people got me permission to go before a subcommittee, and it was the utility companies meeting in Washington discussing utility stuff. And so I think that I had a copy of the layer loading. I talked to them and told them about it. And Georgia Power people, one of them said, I said, that certainly is good information. Said, what about getting you to go to work for us? And I said, buddy, we're busy right now. We're covered up. We can't spread out any further. And when I got back home, one of the Sauk'em members called me and told me that they had just loaded 13 carloads of coal over on New River going to Georgia Power. And it was loaded like that. And I got Neil to call Georgia Power and tell them what was coming. And they sent people out on the yard and met them cars when they come in. And they canceled that strip miner's contract and told him, it said, you will pay for disposal of this waste that you sent us. And that's all I ever heard from that. But no, they. When that spill come, there was an environmentalist come up here with Dr. Sanjay
Gupta
from CNN, and she said that was the worst environmental impact that had ever occurred in the world. Said it was worse than Chernobyl, and of course we won't know. We'll live long enough to know how bad it was, but it was terrible. And with the drinking water, Flint, Michigan ain't got nothing on us.
J.W., a minute ago you were talking about you had too much going on and you couldn't certainly take on Georgia Power's problems. Maureen told us this morning that when AMAX was getting ready to set their sights on the southern coal fields, there was a big debate inside Sauk'em about whether Sauk'em should stay focused on this area, the original footprint of Sauk'em, or whether you should also work in the southern coal fields. Do you remember those debates, and what was your position, and what do you think about it now?
We agreed to go help them, and then we got Sauk'em chapter down there, and we got some Catholic, I don't know what their rating was, but anyway, they had stock in AMAX Corporation, and they went to
shareholder meeting. Shareholder meeting.
Yeah, and they got it. They basically the ones that got it stopped for it.
I see that you've brought up this briefcase, excuse me, and I was going to ask if you had a lot of these sorts of files from your time at Sauk'em and all of your work. Have you given any thought to what you want to happen to any files that you, from your work?
I want somebody to be held accountable for what TVA has done to this area.
Mm. Well, so my perspective obviously is from the archive, and you've spoken to the power of the archive to hold people accountable, and I can tell you that is one function that an archive can play, is that if there are enough records on file, then people can use that as a tool. And so that's why I ask about if you've thought about what you want to do with them.
You want to take some archives with you?
I would love to, but only if you would like to do that.
I told some Saucon people that they could come get them, and they never did come get them. I've still got them here.
Well, in meeting with Maureen this morning and Boomer, I told them that my goal is to give the fullest picture I can of this history. So to that end, I'd like to follow up with the current Saucon leadership and see if they have plans for the full archive of the organization. So if you would be interested in setting up a collection with the University of North Carolina, we would be honored to work with you to do that. But like I said, we would like to think about Boomer, Maureen, and people who stay involved with Saucon as well. So our goal is to tell that full story.
The only thing is that I've got a lot of notes in there, and my spelling is not good.
That's okay. Well, I don't know if you've seen...
My writing's not good.
I don't know if you've seen much 19th century handwriting, but that's what I do all day, is try to read old handwriting, and I've gotten pretty good at it, so that's not a barrier for us, but more so, I just want to plant the seed with you, and if I don't intend to spirit things away today. I want you to think about it,
Look, buddy, I've been thinking about it for over 40 years.
Good. We're here as a service. If we could partner on that, that would be a really great thing. Because like Evangeline Mee that came and spoke with you and then wrote an article, that's really what the archive is about. If you've got the records in front of you and someone wants to write a book or do a documentary film, then there it is in the archive, and they can do that work. So
you want to take them with you today?
I'd be happy to do that if you would like to do that.
I don't know that I can find them. If you come back, I'll...
J.W., we had this discussion amongst us in the Student Health Coalition, where we always sort of thought the archives would go to Vanderbilt because that's where it came from. And some of the archives are there. You know, Bill was in Chapel Hill, so I think we're pretty sure that Bill would want his records to go to Chapel Hill, but we really don't know that. So there was a lot of argument back and forth, and I think what carried the day, at least for me, was that University of North Carolina, this Southern historical thing is several heads and shoulders above anything else around, and so people interested in this are going to gravitate to North Carolina because that's where the stuff is. And going through that collection, it is really impressive about how they are equipped to deal with it. They got a big staff and they know what they're doing. But I think the archives at the University of North Carolina are going to give you a much wider audience of people that are likely to look at this than if you put them at somewhere where there's a little bit less noise.
After we went to Washington, I got acquainted with a senator or a congressman from West Virginia, Ken Heckler. You know of him?
I don't know him.
He has brought up this phase out of strip mining, and he had a bill, and we worked with him basically on this bill to phase out strip mining over a period of time. Mm-hmm. And so I got to be pretty good friends with him. And Environmental Policy Center people asked me if I would write him a letter and get him to change the date, time on the phase out. Well, I didn't see that it would make any difference, but I wrote him a letter and told him that, asked him if he would change the date, time on the phase out. And he wrote me back and said that he was pretty discouraged that I would ask for that. But I've got that letter from him, and we worked with him, and we worked with him until 77, I guess, 75. And when Carter was running for president, he said, if I had been in Gerald Ford's place, mm-hmm. he said, I would have signed that strip mine law at that time. Well, the coal people began to weaken that law. And by the time it come up for passage in 77, I guess it was, why, the Environmental Policy Center had decided that we would be better off with a half a loaf than none.
Right.
And
that's one of my ovens.
So,
I'll give it here.
We went to Washington, Environmental Policy Center. And we formed a coalition of people across the United States, anywhere that had coal, that wanted to be a part of this coalition. That was what it was. And so I got up there and they told me what we was going to do, that they was going to compromise the bill. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. I said, we don't want no compromise on no strip mine bill in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And I got all the people that was there, got enough of them together to vote down the proposal when the Environmental Policy Center asked us to let them go ahead and do it. Well, they said, no, we decided we're going to stay with the phase-out bill. Mm-hmm. And we did that 2 years. 75 and 76, both we voted down the environmental policy recommendation.
Well, we've been talking a little bit today with Boomer and Maureen, and Lark was telling me on the drive to Tennessee about those votes and how back in this area it meant often some violence that would erupt because of the vote and some threats on your life, and is that true, that you really felt in danger during that time?
No, I didn't.
You did.
I had shotguns, and they were long nights that I'd get out and sneak out the back door.
Yeah.
See what was going on. But they threatened us, but you can't stop just because you're being threatened.
Yeah, I understand.
People are not going to like what you're doing, regardless of what it is, if they are opposed to it.
Well, I was going to say something about the idea, if you wanted to set up a collection at the University of North Carolina. I think there's something that's really interesting, is that it mirrors, it's sort of the same principle of your work, that the community should govern and have the say on what is done. And so our project has really been focused on doing that. And so I wanted to point out that, so archiving works the same way. If things are not kept, and over time, if someone wants to look at what happened, if that voice is missing, the voice of the community, then it would be the official records of, let's say, the federal government of the state of Tennessee that would tell the story. So you'd be missing the voice of the community if we don't act to put that in the archive. So that to me is a very similar principle to your work. We really want to mirror that in the design of our project.
Is there anybody in Nashville that'd rather have these archives that I have, or?
J.W., I would imagine anybody whose archive would like to have those archives. They're important things.
Well, have they taken the trouble to come up here and talk to you?
And, we went through this. This was a Tennessee thing. Should we keep it in Tennessee? Well, yeah, that would be nice. But if these things went to Vanderbilt, I mean, I'm not knocking Vanderbilt. They've got, their archives are good, and they know how to keep things and everything. But, you're not going to get this, and you're not going to get, if people are looking for community involvement in Southern things, they're going to go to Carolina, because that's where that's the biggest collection, that's their emphasis. I think you could talk to most people who are currently active in this, and they'd tell you, amongst the Student Health Coalition people, would tell you the same thing. Not all of them are as familiar with BIF and the Carolina thing as we are, but I feel very, very comfortable saying that I feel like this is the best place for those things to go. And I'm not going to do anything with if something is valuable to your thing without being very...
It's just taking up space here.
Well, and, I've got another perspective. I had built out stuff in my house. And I got it out, and I sure am glad I did, because my house burned down. Mm-hmm. And they'd be gone.
Well, that's why I don't have any, I'm not a professional in archiving, but if there's something you have in some boxes that could be saved today and you feel comfortable with the decision, you don't know when Tom would be the first to say, you don't know when something's going to happen, or a flood, or insects, or, I don't know, the decision is yours, but I've kind of gotten to the age in life where you better get her done,
Why not tell him?
When I go to the doctor, if he gives me an appointment several weeks in advance, I ask him if he'd guarantee me
that would be nice if they could. Well, I was going to say, I'm going to take off my University of North Carolina hat and just put on my hat as an individual. I'll say, like if you remember my family, I would say, it doesn't matter where it goes, but I just want to make sure that you have a plan for keeping it and saving it. Mm-hmm. And that's really the most important thing.
I've got enough scars on my legs and stuff that I don't need written paper to prove where I've been. When I was taking these TVA lawyers around where they was layer loading, we went up Massengill Mountain up above Lake City there. And on some land where Howard Baker was having stripping done.
Mm.
And I would tell the news people where to go and send somebody with them. And I'd stay up on the side of the road behind a rock there checking the trucks that come out and see if I knowed who they was and where they was going and stuff. And I kept record of that.
Mm.
And one day, the news people didn't show up when they were supposed to, and I went out to hunt them, and I went around the curve. I saw two men in in a car, and they hollered at me, and I turned and run, and went on up the road a little farther, and I heard somebody behind me, and I looked, and there's a Volkswagen. It had four people in it, I guess. Mm. And they was trying to find me, is what I had in mind. And they hollered at me. And I took off, and I outrun them, got around the curve, and I turned, went right back to them up through the woods. Mm. And they didn't find me. And so when I found the news people, one of them told me later, he said that we was one of their people had rode a truck out of there that they had loaded, and he said he come over the radio, said, "We don't know what's going on up here," but said, "There's a bunch of drunks and they're running all over the place." And I said, "This one but one, and he wasn't drunk."
Hey, before we turn this tape off, and maybe hunt some papers, if you want to, Kate, you, about half an hour ago, you said something about you really wouldn't believe, you know, I don't know your exact word, but, you know, the hurt and the trouble this caused our family, and I just wanted to ask if you would be willing to talk about that a little bit, and, you know, more from the family perspective, or, and you as the mother in the family, and, you know, then maybe we can take a break. But that sounded like a really important comment to me.
Well, it wasn't easy not knowing when he was out, because we didn't ever know whether they was going to kill him, or whether they even threatened to burn our house and all that stuff. And our son was just a young man, and we'd make him come in at dark because we was afraid that he did somebody hurt him. And then later when he was driving, they'd think he'd stayed up, and they'd try to run him off the road. And then I was worried all the time, and it just really, really got to us.
You got threats yourself as well as Jake?
Oh, yeah, they'd talk about us, and they'd say if it wasn't for them little kids, we'd build over that old house of his, and if it wasn't for Kate and them kids, you know, they'd get in the beer joint and threaten us. So, Jay was in Washington once, and there was a whole bunch of coal trucks come and parked on the other side of our road there in front of our house. And they was making noises and saying things, and I just went out there where they was at and told them that. I said, "Now you stay on that side of the road. Don't come on my property." And I just went back in the house and shut the door, and they never did bother us then.
I run a garage here, and one time the Union mine workers had come out on a strike, and there was a guy there that is a customer of mine. They had made an agreement with him. He could continue to work for a while. And so I had his truck in the garage there, and them strikers, they come down there, and they was a mob of them. Oh, he's my brother's here, he tell you about it. But they was going to come in and take that truck and dump it. And I told them they was coming in there and taking nothing. And they turned and left. And there was one time after we bought a piece of land there on the mountain that the strippers started on it. And I went up and told them I wanted them to leave. Mm-hmm. And they did. And I always told them I wasn't afraid of nothing that wiggled or walked. And I just kind of stepped through that.
Well, the good Lord was with us, or there'd have been tragedy in our family. Mm-hmm. And I always knew that. because he's like Donald Trump. He ain't gonna quit.
Well, does anybody have anything else they want to say before I turn the recorder off and maybe we take a stretch and... Okay.
Well, I really just wanted to thank you.
Sort of appreciate your interest.
I'm very, very interested.
That's
and